And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. One of the top grossing films in movie theaters right now is Barbie. And in honor of that, we're going to replay two morning show interviews that both intersect with the story of the Barbie doll. The first interview dates from 2010 and tells the story of the woman responsible for creating the Barbie doll. Enjoy.
What an intriguing story is before us today. And the title of the book does not fully tell the story, Barbie and Ruth. Well, maybe when you hear the name Barbie, you do have some sense. We are going to be talking today about the Barbie doll and about the woman who helped create her. Barbie and Ruth, the story of the world's most famous doll and the woman who created her. Robin Gerber has written a fascinating book here about Ruth Handler, who is the woman largely responsible for that iconic doll called the Barbie doll. And it's a story not only about that, about a groundbreaking development in the toy business, in the doll business, but also the story of a woman at the top of a company at a time when that was exceedingly uncommon. It is also, unfortunately, a story that does not end very happily. It is the story of Mattel and of some great difficulties which they experience, getting a little too big, maybe a little too quickly, or growing in ways that prove to be unwise. A complicated story which Robin Gerber helps us to untangle. Her previous books include Leadership the Eleanor Roosevelt Way, Timeless Strategies from the First Lady of Courage, Katharine Graham, The Leadership Journey of an American Icon, and a novel called Eleanor versus Ike. And she is a lawyer and senior faculty for the Gallup Organization, a senior fellow in the executive education at the Robert H. Smith School of Business, the University of Maryland. And I am very happy to be speaking with her about her fascinating book, Barbie and Ruth, published by HarperCollins. Robin Gerber, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks for having me.
I have to say, I got a couple of long looks from people at the health club as I read this book on the treadmill. I mean, as they kind of spot the cover and see that image of the lower part of one leg of a Barbie doll. But my word, this is a fascinating story. How did you first become acquainted with the story of Ruth Handler? And at what point did it become apparent to you that this was a story worth telling in this kind of detail?
Well, I first learned about Ruth Handler from a book, actually, that was put out called Enterprising Women, about other women business owners. And she was in this book, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. The Barbie doll was actually created by a woman. I had no idea. And then as I investigated, I discovered that she had also founded Mattel Toy Company, one of the great American companies. And then, of course, as I read more about her story, I learned that besides building this great company and doing lots of innovative things as a business person, she then had this tragic fall from grace where she overextended the company, as you alluded to, and was convicted of fraud, and also had breast cancer at the same time. So this terribly tragic period in her life. But then she redeems herself, comes back, founds a new company making prosthetic inserts for women who lost their breasts to cancer, and really becomes a hero to breast cancer survivors. And 10 years ago at Barbie's 40th anniversary celebration, Mattel had her sitting at the head table. So it's a great story of success and failure and coming back.
Hmm. It's also the story of an intriguing partnership and marriage between she and her husband, Elliot. Talk for just a moment about what an intriguing pair they were, and of how important he was in this story and in the story of the Barbie doll.
Yes, it's a wonderful love story. We're coming up to Valentine's Day, so it's appropriate to talk about that part of it. They met, they were both children of immigrants, of Polish-Jewish immigrants living in Denver. They met when they were 16 years old, and they were together for over 65 years. Elliot was a wonderful designer and artist, very creative person, but a very, very shy person. Ruth used to say he couldn't order his own food in a restaurant, but she believed in him. every one of those years. And when he started making things, she said, I'm going to sell these. It started with ashtrays and trinkets made out of a new plastic material called Lucite. And, of course, then ended up with toys.
I want to read a description you give us of their partnership. You say, Ruth and Elliot's unique partnership established many of its patterns in those early days. She had an optimistic view no matter the situation and kept Elliot's spirits up. She had a boisterous adventurism that pulled him along, and he had a quiet, steady, unwavering love for her. And at the end of their work days, there was much to talk, share, and dream about. I mean, I think many partnerships are, in a sense, unlikely in the way that this one was. I mean, kind of odd pairings, balancing of opposites, and so on. But it's really fascinating to be able to follow this partnership and to see how it worked for these two.
Yes, it was very complementary in the way that they sort of filled in each other's gaps, I guess you could say. And, you know, certainly Ruth was a lot more volatile and quick to react, quick to get angry. And Elliot was always the calm one. He was the one, the very, very steady one. But as that passage suggests, he was also the one who didn't have that kind of absolute optimism, absolute confidence that I think you need if you're going to found a business and build a huge business like she did.
By the way, tell us about his name. I mean, what his name ultimately became.
Oh, that is an interesting story. He was, as a young man, he was called Izzy because his name was Itzhak Elliot Handler. And in the community where he grew up, they called him Izzy as a nickname. And when they were driving across the desert after they were married, to live in Los Angeles, Ruth turns to him and she says, I'd like you to start calling yourself Elliot now that we're starting a new life, because Izzy, frankly, sounds too Jewish. And she was concerned about anti-Semitism. She'd experienced some anti-Semitism against her brother, who was nicknamed Muzzy, and some police officers. There had been an incident where they had made fun of him for that name in a very anti-Semitic way. And so I think she was worried about it, and it made her uncomfortable going to this new place. She wasn't, I think they were, you know, as many children of immigrants, they were trying to fit in. And so she said, would you change your name and start calling yourself Elliot? I like it a lot better. And he said, sure. So he started to be called Elliot.
You say unconsciously they were moving away from their roots and edging closer to assimilation, heading toward a storybook realization of the American dream. They are in Los Angeles, I believe, as this business venture first gets underway. And I want you to tell our listeners the fascinating story about the first order which was placed for some of their goods at a moment in time when they didn't even have letterhead or anything official to even write down an order. Tell our listeners that great story.
Oh, yes. Well, Ruth went into a very high-end store, you know, a very fancy gift shop in Los Angeles, and just marches in with some of Elliot's designs. Now, at this point, he is making things out of Lucite that are really like ashtrays, bookends, just kind of, incidental sort of small items. And she takes these into the store and she says, you ought to buy these. And the owner of the store says, well, I have to come and see your workshop. Well, their workshop was basically a garage, a messy garage. And so she says, well, come on Saturday, because she wants to be there. And she had a day job at Paramount Studios. So, and she figures Elliot can't handle this, you know. So this man shows up and he looks around. He says, fine, I'll place an order. It was their first order. For them, it was rather large. And Elliot realizes in a panic he doesn't even have a piece of paper. So he sort of tears off the end of a bag or something and writes down this order. And as soon as this man leaves, they just are jumping up and down and screaming, because this is actually the first order of what would eventually become Mattel Toy Company.
Tell us about that jump which they make from household items into the toy business.
Yeah. Well, what happens is, they're making these items, and Ruth actually gets pregnant and has to stay home, so she can't be part of that company. Elliot gets a partner, and they form a company called Elzac, which is making these trinkets and women's jewelry, costume jewelry. And Ruth, meanwhile, can't really stand staying home, so she's going to go back into business, and she decides to sell, again, some of Elliot's designs, which were picture frames. But he is also tinkering on the side with making dollhouse furniture out of these little pieces of scrap wood and other materials. And sure enough, she finds she can sell the dollhouse furniture. So that was really the first kind of toy that they made. And Elliot just liked toys. When I interviewed him, he said, well, I'm really a kid at heart. I still love toys.
Hmm. We're speaking with Robin Gerber, and we're talking about her book, Barbie and Ruth. So one of the most interesting breakthroughs which occurs with this development of this thing, which came to be known as the Barbie doll, was an entirely new idea about what a doll should be and what kind of dolls girls would most enjoy playing with. This is one of the most basic things that I never knew until I read your book. Until the Barbie doll came along, what kind of dolls did girls play with?
Yeah, if you were a little girl, as I was in the 1950s, you could really, to actually play with a three-dimensional doll, you would get a baby doll. That's what you would get. And so you would play it being mommy. And that was it. Really wasn't much else you could play at when you had a baby doll. But Ruth noticed that her daughter and her friends were often playing with paper dolls, because paper dolls, of course, were adult dolls. And I remember also playing with paper dolls for that same reason, that I wanted to play at being an adult. And Ruth saw this and said, well, little girls really want to play at being big girls. Let's give them a doll to do it with. But it took her quite a while, a number of years, to convince her designers that mothers would possibly buy a doll for their daughters that had breasts. The men just couldn't imagine such a thing happening.
You know, it's really interesting to think about, as she observed this, her daughter and her friends playing with these flimsy paper dolls and mimicking adult conversation and, I mean, taking on the role of grown-up women and obviously enjoying it. You know, she realizes if girls find themselves wanting to do that with something like a paper doll, imagine what they might do if they had something more realistic in their hands. I mean, realistic, I suppose, with quotes around it, but I mean, what if they had a real doll versus a paper doll? I mean, what a brilliant insight that is.
Yeah, and I think, as I say in the book, I think it was, she always said, oh, I thought of this because I saw my daughter playing with paper dolls. But I think there was something deeper going on, which is that she was a little girl who always wanted to play, who always wanted to be a bigger girl. And she didn't play at it because she was the 10th child of her parents and last child. Her mother was ill after she was born and gave her to be raised by her oldest sister. Now, the sister never had other children and worked all the time with her husband, owned a store, owned a deli counter. And when she was 10 years old, Ruth said to her sister slash mother, I want to go to work. And at 10 years old, she was working behind the counter in this deli, and she describes not really having many friends, and she just loved to work and be around adults. So if you think about it, she was that little girl who wanted to be a big girl. So I think that was where the insight really came from.
Now, she has this idea that Mattel should make a new kind of doll, but unfortunately, she is unable to convince her own designers that it makes sense or that it can be done. Tell us about the discovery she makes during a trip to Europe, which in a sense ends up making all the difference in making all this happen.
Yes, it did, because these male designers at Mattel did not want to make this doll. They gave her all kinds of excuses. You know, one excuse was that they couldn't mold such a doll with these tiny hands and feet with the current kind of plastics that they had at the time in the molding processes, or that it would cost too much money to do it. Well, then she goes on a trip to Europe in 1955 with her family, and in a toy shop window in Luzern, Switzerland, sees a doll that you and I would think of as Barbie. But in fact, this doll started its life a few years before that as the three-dimensional realization of a cartoon character, and a very popular cartoon character named Lily, in one of the German newspapers. And Lily, in the cartoons, is actually a prostitute. And the cartoonist who made this cartoon had the idea that men would like a gag toy of Lily. And so Lily was born as a gag sex toy for men. But even in Europe, little girls saw this toy doll and said, I want that. And so it had gradually worked its way into toy shops, and that's when Ruth found the doll, brought it home. Her daughter wanted one. She got one for her daughter, two for herself, went back to Mattel and handed it to her designer and said, figure out how to make this. This is the doll I've been talking about.
Well, and of course, when you hand over a doll to somebody who says it can't be done, that's all the proof you need that in fact it can be done. I mean, somebody is doing it and we need to do it too.
Exactly.
By the way, you do make mention at some point that ultimately the company responsible for the Lily doll goes after Mattel. I mean, believing, and to some extent probably quite rightly, that their idea and design had in a sense been stolen.
Yes. Well, it was, wasn't it? And they did. They brought a suit. They went through various machinations. But at the end of the day, Mattel bought the rights to the Lily doll for about $20,000.
Getting these actually made is an interesting challenge. And you tell us that some of the complications came because much of the manufacturing actually occurred in Japan. And due to the language and cultural barriers of the time, there were some interesting mistakes made and miscommunications in terms of very important details, including
yes.
some important details of Barbie's body.
Exactly. This was the beginning of, you know, companies going to Japan for the cheap workforce over there. And so Mattel had done this. They had started going to Japan to manufacture toys. This was a new kind of plastic they were using, a new kind of molding process. Actually, the Japanese didn't know how to do it any better than the Americans, and so the engineers were struggling over there to figure out how to make this doll. And as you say, they were also struggling to understand what this doll was supposed to look like. The Japanese really didn't like this doll very much. They didn't like her looks. And they kept forming her with nipples on those breasts. And Mattel didn't quite want to go that far. And so finally, Jack Ryan, who was the engineer in charge of this over in for Mattel over in Japan, one day he just got so frustrated, he took out a file and just filed off those nipples so that the Japanese would finally understand that Barbie was just supposed to have those smooth breasts that we know that she has today. So there were definitely some humorous missteps.
Right. And, of course, you outline other important details such as the rotational molding, which gave Barbie that ability to move and twist and so on, which we know very well. Of course, another big breakthrough, besides the fact that Barbie is an adult, is also the fact that she would have all of these different outfits, all of these different sorts of clothes. That's the kind of thing we just take for granted now. It's just such a ubiquitous part of the doll business, but apparently this was quite unprecedented, at least here in America.
Yeah, that was another great innovation of Ruth's. From the minute she saw that Lily doll, she went in and she said, okay, I'd like these three dolls, and then I'd like some more outfits. And they said, oh, no, there's no other outfits. You buy the doll. You want another outfit? You buy another doll. And Ruth said, thought to herself, well, that's the stupidest thing in the world. Let's just sell the doll, and we'll make all kinds of clothes. And children can just buy the other clothes, which, of course, was the genius of this. It was the razor blade theory, as Elliot liked to say. Once you buy the razor, you got to get those razor blades. And so this is a huge part, of course, of the Barbie market, became the pieces of clothing that you could get. And even today, a doll is quite cheap. You can get a Barbie for as cheap as $5. But then the company knows you're going to buy all those clothes and accessories.
So it is successful fairly soon, but not immediately. Tell us about at least the brief hesitancy on the part of stores to purchase and stock this doll.
Yeah, well, in the beginning, it was quite a shock for Ruth. She unveiled the doll March 9th, 1959, at the Toy Fair. Had a big, beautiful display for Barbie, and all these male buyers came in from the stores, including Sears, which was a very big buyer at the time. And they looked at this doll and turned up their noses and walked out, and she got very few orders and was absolutely devastated, calling Japan in a panic because she'd ordered so much inventory. And the worst thing in the toy business is to have inventory that you can't get out of the warehouse. Well, she had also done something very innovative, which was to make a television commercial for this doll that really portrayed Barbie as a real person. And no doll had ever been advertised this way. And after Toy Fair, little girls started seeing this television ad. Not too much happened for a couple of months, but then they got out of school. And once they were out of school for summer break, they started demanding this doll from their parents, and suddenly demand shot up, and it took 3 years for Mattel to actually catch up with demand after that.
It's probably important for us to understand, too, that that this doll was being marketed in a way that was quite unprecedented, that, if I remember correctly, commercials before then had decidedly been pointed at parents, and these were commercials which were designed with little kids in mind.
Yes, we have Ruth Handler to thank for that. That actually started in 1955 when Disney started that show, The Mickey Mouse Club. And for the first time, they offered the opportunity to toy companies to advertise for the entire year. In fact, you had to advertise for the entire year if you wanted to advertise on the Mickey Mouse Club. Now, toy companies had never done that. They only advertised right before Christmas, and actually they didn't go on TV very often. They mostly advertised in catalogs, and some people will remember those catalogs were aimed at parents, advising parents what toys to buy for their kids, so that children were not really being considered as consumers. Ruth changed all that, and we might love her or hate her for it, but she bought into the Mickey Mouse Club, bet her whole worth of her company, $500,000, to buy those ads for a year. And, of course, it paid off magnificently.
But it did
change the way toys were sold, because now ads were aimed at kids, and kids were the ones demanding what would be bought.
In fact, someone who worked for her told a reporter, and you quote him this way, that retailers were irked because television advertising undercut their influence in the industry. The ads forced them to buy what Mattel advertised, that is, the stores. It used to be store buyers dictated what toys would sell, meaning the stores themselves. But Mattel reversed that, and all of this became much more public-driven. Again, that's the kind of thing that we can't even imagine that world, because it is so much the reverse, and we are so entrenched in exactly the opposite.
Yeah, and also the idea that this really single-handedly, Ruth Handler did make this change, and there are many books that credit Mattel and, you know, her this change that she made and she came up with. She had the vision, and this is the thing about founders of companies, people who build great companies, having that big vision of how things can be changed to benefit their company.
So she goes on to design variations on Barbie, and of course along comes Ken and Skipper and others, and all kinds of things. Eventually Mattel expands into other ventures, including Hot Wheels, which are incredibly popular and successful. Then things begin to go wrong. In whatever time remains to us, tell us about kind of the way in which all of this falls apart.
Yeah, well, in 1970, Ruth believes that Mattel's a $300 million company and there's just no more room to grow. And so she has the idea to start buying up other companies. Ringling Brothers Circus became a Mattel company. They bought a movie company, made the movie Sounder. But they were buying these companies with Mattel stock, which was very highly valued. And then comes a bad quarter. Profits are down. Can't let Wall Street know because that'll sink the stock price. And so Ruth cooks the books and is caught in doing this, along with some of her other executives, and is convicted of SEC of fraud by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Ends up with the longest community service sentence ever given to a white-collar criminal up to that time, but lucky she didn't go to jail. I think the judge actually took pity on her because during this terrible ordeal with the company, she also got breast cancer.
That gives us
and
the opportunity.
She lost a breast.
Let's talk then just briefly about Nearly Me, which is a very important undertaking for her.
Well, when terrible things happen to people, they can do all kinds of things and crawl into holes, but that wasn't Ruth's way. She went back to her core skills, building a company, and she founded a new company, as you said, Nearly Me, making breast prosthetics inserts for bras for women who'd had mastectomies like herself. She built a woman-owned company, went around and fitted women personally, had a great experience for herself, and just became a hero to women who had suffered from breast cancer and losing a breast because now they could look good again and have their dignity back. So it was a great redemptive thing that she did for herself and for other women.
Much more in the pages of this fascinating book, Barbie and Ruth, published by HarperCollins. Robin Gerber, I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to The Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program also comes from The Morning Show archives. It's a 2009 interview with Jerry Oppenheimer talking about his book that examines the sometimes controversial history of the company that produces the Barbie doll, Mattel. Here it is. I'm excited at the chance to speak once again with well-known, best-selling author Jerry Oppenheimer. And surely you know that name well for some of the books which he has written in the past. He has written books about the Kennedys, the Hiltons, Martha Stewart, Barbara Walters, Jerry Seinfeld. He and I actually spoke about his book about Jerry Seinfeld. For book number 9, Jerry Oppenheimer is actually doing something in some respects a little bit different. That is, he is not tackling a person, but rather an entire company. And it's one of the most famous companies in America, Mattel, creators of, among other things, the famous Barbie doll, and lots of other things. It's a ride which has been a fairly turbulent one. There was a time when Mattel was as successful as any company in America, and achieved that success with some groundbreaking innovations. And then things became much rougher for Mattel due to all kinds of different missteps. And all of that and more chronicled in a really interesting book called Toy Monster, The Big Bad World of Mattel, in which Jerry Oppenheimer, in his inimitable style, introduces us to some of the primary players in the rocky history of this company. The book is published by Wiley, and we have a few minutes to speak with Jerry Oppenheimer about the story of Mattel and some of the most interesting figures who have walked its hallways. Jerry Oppenheimer, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you for having me again.
It is an intriguing departure in some ways, not in every way. I mean, there are a lot of ways in which this book feels exactly like the Jerry Oppenheimer books of the past. But in terms of your target, it is a little bit different. Tell us what prompted you to write this book, and in particular to write a book about a company versus a single person.
Well, as you had noted in your preamble, I've written about major iconic figures, you know, Martha Stewart, Barbara Walters, the Clintons, the Kennedys, the Hilton dynasty, which covered the lives from the hotel founder Conrad Hilton up to the life of the famous for being famous granddaughter of his, Paris Hilton. But this time I decided that I wanted to find an iconic institution, an institution that everyone, generations of parents and children, have had some contact with. And Mattel seemed to fit the bill. You know, the company was founded right after World War II in a garage by two entrepreneurial young people by the name of Ruth and Elliot Handler, who came from Eastern European immigrant Jewish stock. The Handlers themselves had very little education beyond high school, but they were very street smart, very aggressive, very ambitious, and they started this company. The other two reasons I decided to go with an institution like Mattel is because back in 2007, you may recall, a dark cloud hovered over this the world's largest toy company. Mattel does business in 140 countries around the world, and it is a public company on the stock exchange, suddenly, Mattel was in the headlines. 20 million toys during what I call the toy terror of 2007 were recalled because of lead paint, dangerous levels of lead paint, I might add, found in literally millions of toys that Mattel has manufactured in China. Mattel, like a lot of other companies, outsources most or all of its production to China and some other countries. So here, this lead paint was discovered. Beyond that, there was a design flaw in one of its more popular contemporary toys called Polly Pockets, in which tiny magnets that were part of the inducement for people buying the product were being swallowed by young children. They were being made ill. They were injured internally. Some nearly died and had to go undergo emergency surgery. So I was struck by the fact that, you know, a company so trusted and supposedly beloved by people, children, was suddenly in the midst of a scandal. Beyond that, this year is the 50th anniversary of the Barbie doll. The most iconic, best-selling toy ever has been the centerpiece of Mattel's history. And those two kind of news pegs inspired me to say to myself, you know, this could be the institution I want to write about, and what do we know about this company? Where did it come from? What has been the corporate culture there for so many years? Who are the cast of characters who brought out these iconic toys like Barbie and Chatty Cathy and Hot Wheels? I mean, you know, Jack in the Box. They go on and on forever. And what I discovered was really kind of the dark side of Toyland. I think most people probably view a toy company as a happy, joyful, wonderful place to work. I mean, there's been movies about, you know, Toyland, toy companies, Tom Hanks film, Big was one of those kinds of movies. And in reality, this was shark-infested waters, highly competitive people, scandals, red flags raised, whistleblowers. And one of the other things I do terms of the book is I discovered that for years there had been a myth surrounding the birth of Barbie, so to speak. Ruth Handler, who was one of the co-founders of Mattel, had written a book called Dream Doll, an autobiography which was written basically by a journalist who had been hired to write the book, in which she claimed full and complete credit for discovering, creating, inventing, engineering, everything you could do to bring Barbie to life and introducing her in 1959. But what I discovered in extensive interviews with people who had worked at Mattel as designers and inventors and engineers during that period when the Handlers were running Mattel was, in fact, that the actual inventor, the father of Barbie, was a brilliant Yale engineering school graduate who had gone from designing weapons of mass destruction for the Cold War Pentagon to getting a job at Mattel as a senior design consultant and bringing Barbie to life, resulting in years of feuding with Ruth Handler, because you had two kind of driven, ambitious people butting heads, especially over who brought Barbie to life. So it became an intriguing soap opera story behind the scenes, what was going on at Mattel.
In what respect do you think, if you think it is this exceptional in corporate America? I think there are some people who would suggest that you could walk down the hallways of just about any major company, and these are the kind of stories that one is likely to uncover. But do you think that's particularly true at Mattel? I mean, is Mattel exceptional in this respect?
Well, I don't know if Mattel is exceptional in this respect. What I do know is that I think people have a different concept of a toy company as opposed to GM or Chrysler or Ford or any of the major corporations in this country. And especially when you're dealing with a product that is aimed at children. I mean, one of the issues that I discovered when I began looking into the toy terror of 2007 was the fact that Mattel has a long history of dangerous toys that were produced and marketed beyond what was discovered in 2007. One was a toy called Incredible Edibles, in which Mattel actually decided that they found in their chem lab a way to produce a toy that was actually edible. And once that toy was brought out into the marketplace, it was discovered and had to be taken off the shelves, that children who suffered from childhood diabetes were becoming ill from eating this gloppy, gooey mess that Mattel was highly promoting as a fun toy. Even the iconic Jack in the Box, which I think probably everyone has had as a child, had major problems. There was a defect in the manufacturing of the spring. And this was at a time when the toys were being made here in the U.S. and not in China. And at least one child was blinded. Mattel was big on guns and produced all kinds of toy guns for boys. And one of them produced such a loud noise that it almost deafened children. So the history of bad toys as opposed to good toys has been part of Mattel's history, which I document for the first time in the book. So I think in terms of Mattel being a public company that has to generate big revenues to impress Wall Street and make its stockholders happy and fat and sassy, it is like a lot of other companies. But the fact that it produces products for children makes it somewhat different. And over the years, Mattel's prime goal, because it's been a public company since the 1960s, is the fact that it has to generate big revenue. And it has to generate that revenue over any other issues involved in the production of toys. I go into the fact that Ruth Handler, the co-founder of Mattel, actually was one of the first female white-collar criminals long before Martha Stewart, who I had written about in a previous book, and Leona Helmsley, who had gone to prison for tax evasion. Back in the mid-70s, when Mattel suddenly was having financial problems and was putting out allegedly false revenue statements and giving Wall Street good news instead of the reality of bad news, she was found to have been essentially cooking Mattel's books, along with several other executives, was indicted by a federal grand jury for 7 months, denied any wrongdoing, and at the end of that time, as part of a plea bargain deal, which kept her at the age of 61 out of prison, she pleaded no contest to these various charges of manipulating Mattel's stocks and revenues, et cetera, et cetera. and was ousted from the company, was forced to do the a term of community service longer than any other community service term in the past, and was, you know, basically brought Mattel to its corporate knees, a company that she and her husband had worked so hard to make huge. So it's just an amazing story of corporate corruption and misdeeds, along with making many kids happy. It's just a bizarre story.
And I guess, as you say, the fact that it's a toy company, and we want to imagine it being one thing when, in fact, these kind of corporate realities are in such sharp contrast to that idyllic image we might have. I need to ask you a similar question to one I asked you when I asked, when we talked about your Jerry Oppenheimer, or your Jerry Seinfeld book, namely the fact that when you are writing kind of unvarnished portraits of famous people, certainly some of the people you're going to talk to are people who, for one reason or another, are disgruntled, maybe disgruntled former or present employees who have a very particular image of the person in question, and maybe a very particular perspective or view certain events through a certain prism of interpretation. I should think, in some respects, that's even a bigger issue when you are writing a book about an entire company. Take us through your process by which you sort out what people tell you, and how you are able to sort of get at the heart of who's telling the truth here, and who, on the other hand, is speaking out of great bitterness caused by, you know, one thing or another. How do you, as the author, sort through that kind of a tangle?
Yeah, that's absolutely true in the kinds of books I do. I try to be as objective as possible. I never actually put my opinions into the book. Doing a biography or even a history of a company like Mattel, I try to interview as many people as possible. And it's correct that those sometimes more willing to speak are those who have issues with the person, or the, or in this case, Mattel. People have been fired, people have been treated badly. I try to interview the broad spectrum of possible subjects who have great knowledge about my particular subject. I don't go into these subjects at all with any sort of bias. I try to be as objective as possible. And when I find a controversial issue, if I'm interviewing someone and they come up with some scandalous fact or questionable, controversial issue, I always try to get a second or third source to support it. In other words, it's almost like having one or two or three cameras on one particular scene in a film. So I try to get all angles, and usually the first person I speak to is supported by the second or third. I find that in having done 9 books and now working on my 10th, people are very honest. Very few of them have agendas. I'm actually calling these people or contacting these people out of the blue. You know, some haven't been involved with the with Mattel for 10 or 15 or 20 years, or even from the beginning of its founding, and they are happy to reminisce about their lives there, what the corporate culture was like. And be very open and honest. I've never found anyone who has lied to me because I've checked out what they told me and it turned out to be true. Bizarrely, when I was doing the Martha Stewart book, which is called Just Desserts, and was a New York Times bestseller for a number of weeks, I actually discovered during my research that Martha was telling people she figured I would be interviewing to actually lie to me, tell me mistruths, so she could in you know, somewhere when the book was published, be able to say that Jerry Oppenheimer published falsehood. So that's the only time I've ever encountered anything like that. And having written 9 essentially independent biographies, meaning they are not authorized by the subject, I'm very careful in my reporting. I've been an investigative reporter for many years and have never been sued. So, indeed, I try and get at least 2 sources on certain controversial or questionable issues that are brought up during interviews.
For the great success and also stunning reversals that Mattel has experienced over its long history, give us some sense of where they are right now.
Well, Mattel is being faced, like so many other businesses around the world, with the recession. And their revenues are down, sales are down. They've just come out of what's considered the biggest and most contentious corporate court case in history, and that is the case involving Mattel versus MGA and MGA Entertainment. MGA is a company that in the early to mid-90s introduced a doll called the Bratz dolls, and I'm sure your listeners who have children will be familiar with those. These were dolls of a very sexy, ethnic nature that were based more on the tabloid train wreck characters that little girls today know about, the Paris Hiltons and the Lindsay Lohans and that group. And Mattel claimed in court that the idea was stolen from them. Whether that's true or not, it was hard to tell in terms of the trial. That case is still dragging on. Mattel's stock value has dropped. Barbie sales, and now we're in the year of her 50th anniversary, are far down from earlier years. So Mattel is struggling. Hopefully when the recession ends, it'll get back on its feet. But there's been a lot of criticism from people I interviewed who were designers and engineers that Mattel, through the years, began losing its creativity and was depending more on trying to please Wall Street and the stockholders rather than trying to please children. And that a lot of that has to do with the decline in sales of Barbie. Barbie became kind of an outdated product, even though she's still the largest selling toy in the world. Her popularity has diminished a great deal. Kids today are interested in, at 7 years old, they have their own laptop computers, they have cell phones, they're interested in video games. So the day that, the period when Barbie was the most in-demand toy, and kids wanted to play with little cars and dolls, that's all changed. And I think Mattel is struggling to get into the minds of today's children and see exactly what they want and try and bring out those products. It's not an easy issue because kids are very fickle in what they want to play with, and what's popular for 6 months suddenly ends and a new idea has to be generated.
Well, it's quite a story told in an interesting book called Toy Monster, The Big Bad World of Mattel. The book is published by Wiley. Jerry Oppenheimer, I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes.
Thank you for having me.
Monday on the morning show, Luke Nichter and his fascinating